another thing which is coming to my mind is, you know, so what is the, ultimately what is a lexicon or what is this? Is it an interface that that somebody comes and engages with you, or it's a work itself? Are we trying to create an interface? Like, I don't really believe in also in categories. Like sometimes a few workshops which we have done around different art college of design, we end up doing something completely different. Like going to the Shantiniketan for some, this theme was censorship and thing, and we end up doing some public art, or they say they want to do it, their desires, and they end up doing it. So what I'm trying to ask, that's what we are getting into, like this whole exercise, is it an interface that this dictionary is, like dictionary has been an interface for somebody to intervene into this language. Like I have collected about 7-8 dictionaries, like from oral tribes, which they don't have any language, like written language, but like British, when they come, they need two things. They, you know, they make translate the Bible. Like many of the tribes, the only literature which they say, yes, I have to be autonomous, I am want to get away from India because I have my thing. So that is the Bible, and second is the dictionary, and both of them has been translated or made by British, you know, anthropologists. So what is this? It's like, you know, first, then later when Indian officials comes, they engage with this dictionary or lexicons. So it is ever getting complex situations of new disciplines, new things, like working with video, then running a boat, then talking to 10 different people. So do we need a kind of for people to access us, or a multiple you know, kind of entry which is also tangible, also fluid, also transient? I don't know. Is it an interface? Are we really saying it's a question to all, I think. Is it an interface, or is it a work in itself?
That idea is really fascinating. Word as an interface is really interesting, I think.
Okay.
And I also spoke about different kinds of language, not literary language. There is a whole language. There is also a language system in some tribe in South America, which I know very briefly. They don't have a system of naming things. So how does that exist?
I believe there's also a, I think Jibesh remembered this story much better. But the idea that your personal name changed with the day, or with the time of the day, or with what you were feeling. I mean, and this is I'll have to call up to get information, which I can do at a later point. But there is a community that has not believed in even the limitation of name, which is that I am not the same person all the time, so I cannot be the same name at all times. Sorry? Post-ego society. Or but one could think about multiple egos Bombay. In which there are, you know, you could also call it a schizophrenic society, but I think I'm not. I'm just
Bombay instead of Mumbai, you have to apologize to Raj Thackeray.
Luckily, I'm out of Raj Thackeray's ambit, so it doesn't matter what I say. But I'm just saying that the idea of I think Mriganka has asked a very interesting question, and this becomes not only a question for the exercise of the moment, but also as a kind of fundamental question, because the idea of lexicons, while they're, you know, like so many things, they're both things that you can't do without, but have very contested histories, like especially the imperial history, for example, in so many parts of India, comes directly uses dictionaries as the first building block, which of course has also in many instances given communities what they did not have, which is a kind of reference structure which is convenient to have, because if you share something which is not in which there is dispersal, what happens when you have a community which is not dispersing, then the notion of a shared language is not, you know, it's given. There is a sum of us, and we inhabit in the same space, so we have a shared language. There is no need for a kind of a quantification of that sharing. It is precisely as Kaushik and I were discussing for the last few days, the idea of dispersal, which is something which in some ways is modern, in some ways is older, that the question of a common reference becomes relevant. But when it provides you that kind of thing, but it also has hegemonizing histories and so on and so forth. So I think it becomes an interesting question when we think about it either as you know, as the idea of interface, or as interface as opposed to, I don't think that, I think a dictionary is often an artifact in the other way, that you think as a kind of, as an object, which, I think if you think of it as a skin that you must, I don't know, I'm just thinking aloud, but how is it, I'm just thinking aloud, because how, this question is not only relevant, is relevant for, I think, the exercise at hand. What is it that one wants to see a lexical project being? Does it exist in and of itself, or does it work at the level of veils which are going to be pulled off, or an interface that, what is the function of the interface? Because if you think of digital interfaces, that it is a skin that you must, which leads you to other things, which is one way of thinking about it. But how are you guys thinking about the question of the interface? Oh, I mean, this. What are your thoughts on, your desires on the matter, shall we just say? Not thoughts necessarily. Maybe not thoughts, just desires.
Well, I mean, the whole question of translation, which is very much linked to what you're talking about, is vast, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's perhaps more fascinating than the question of the lexicon itself. I take an example. There's a French philosopher, Barbara Cassin, who coordinated initially in French a dictionary, a very extensive dictionary of philosophical terms. It's called the Europe. I think it was initially called the Encyclopedia of Philosophical Terms, but there is now a European-wide and even extra-European project to translate this encyclopedic endeavor to define philosophical terminology in all the other languages. But of course, the words that were in the French version mostly came from other languages. So in no language where this book is translated will anything really be naturalized, because when they're translated back into German, of course, where some of them came from, or back into Greek, where in an older version they also came from, they'll bear the traces of that trajectory. And so it is in itself a philosophical, not only a philological or translational task to carry this out. And actually, at the moment, I'm translating it myself. A text was written in French by an Egyptian psychoanalyst on it's simply called Freudian terminology in Arabic, but it's written in French, and I'm translating it into English. The adventure of Freud's terms that were disseminated and then that were taught to Raja Ben Slama, who then went back, after studying and learning them in French, went back to her native Egypt, where she's a practicing psychoanalyst. And now the trick is to get, and she explains the nuances, of course, of what these words meant to her in French and what they ended up as in Arabic. It's incredibly interesting. And actually, I think for someone who knew anything about Sanskrit, it would be even more interesting, because, of course, they also bear many times the traces of that pre-Freudian history. So what is this? What is the nature of such a, I mean, beyond its sort of fascinating aspect? Is it an interface? Interface seems like a very shallow term, actually. It seems like an interface always strikes me as sort of as a plane. But in fact, but it's not a doorway. It's not a threshold at all. You see, that's the thing, is that it's really a much more complex geometrical figure, a much more paradoxical one, because it's not as if one language came into contact with another. All the languages were penetrated by one another at different times and then repenetrated. So, you know, with an interface, you know, you can one entity can hook to another. It's the point of contact. But it's not about contact. It's really about I'm not finding the adequate term, and I'm not sure that there is one in this case to describe this degree of saturation of each language by each other one. And that is an absolutely, for a translator.
But one is not, there are not only there is not only translation between discrete languages, which is what, which I think you've raised, which is fast, you know, which is interesting, and as you pointed out in that instance, an impossible project of trans, of how can you constantly remake meaning. But there is also translation, say, across form and across disciplines, and you know, often the, some if I say something which I can speak it either in a kind of in the language of discipline, or I can speak it in the language as it is said for in a non-disciplinary way, and I am at that time also making a certain kind of translation, taking certain set of ideas. Analogies are kind of translations, if you, which they're not, but I'm just saying how. Then the question, which part of the not dilemma, but part of the discussion that is going on today is really this question of translation across disciplines as well. And how does, can one, and this is part of the excitement of doing something like this, is that you make not a neologism necessarily, but whatever word you decide to think about, you're bringing different disciplines or different languages or different histories of into making that new meaning or reef, whatever we want to call that. But it is also part of the obstruction, as it were, in discussion, is that which one will get what say, and what exactly is the kind of translation that is going on, and that I think is also part of the well.
I mean, there's one thing that comes through in these discussions, to me at least. I mean, things that I've been thinking about. Recently, French philosopher Jean-Jacques Le Cercle and Denise Riley went back to the idea of Vygotsky's notion of inner speech and wrote a terrific book on inner speech. And they said that we need to revive the idea, because I find it fascinating, because in cinema studies, I think inner speech can be an incredibly productive idea to think through cinema. It's a very, it's something. So for a psychoanalyst, inner speech is ego reportage or something like that. But the point that they make there is very interesting, that Denise Riley has this essay on bad words, you know, which kind of could connect up with slang, community slang and things like that. And she kind of takes a Lacanian position on it and talks about how the Lacanian kind of relationship between the petit objet A that he talks about, you know, and the big other, you know, that. The inner speech, when it becomes a bad word, is somewhere, you know, an inner speech translated through this gradient between the petit objet A, which is the unconscious, which we don't know, and the big other, which is like, you know, which can take over. Now, that's the thing about naming. I think what's very interesting about naming it is that's the gradient of intensities, grips, you know. How people name things and what they want to do with that name and how they want to project it into a space, and what results they want out of that naming, is, I think, far more interesting to think through than actually naming itself, because there are gradations of desire. Some people want to do very drastic things with naming, like, I want this name to make a historical difference. You know, I mean, that is a desire which is projected, and the performance around that naming is equally intense. And there can be other forms of naming, like sitting here, for example. I might want to name things which I'm naming, but it's at the level of inner speech, which I don't register, but I'm still naming, I mean, somewhere. And it might come to me after 2 years, what I named, and things like that, you know. I mean, so this whole, that naming is a process. I mean, that's what I'm fascinated by with the whole logic of naming. It's also a notion of grips, of intensities, of psychoanalytical kind of stages between psychosis, depression, or whatever, you know. I mean, if one wants to talk medically about states of the mind, it's somewhere located in that locus, and that's where a difference between, say, anthropology or history would be located as well. For me as a discipline, one of the greatest challenges I faced right at the beginning of training, because I was doing ancient history, was what is historical and what is anthropological? Everything is anthropological at the end of the day, and everything is historical at the end of the day. And then to actually come to terms with the naming complexities of these two disciplinarian practices was an incredible task, because I mean it's a level of, you know, trying to get to completely different registers of naming, describing the same thing in absolutely different terms, and
And there you come to terms with this notion of intensity, that I realize that there's an intensity of logic, that historical naming is far more intense and has a agent causality, making change in the world kind of logic, whereas anthropological naming is not. It's a looser grip on the same phenomenon, and it names differently because it has a looser grip on the same phenomenon. And that was the only way I could come to terms with it, because I couldn't deny the two, because there are traditions involved of practice, of historical action and history being recorded, and there is everyday life and anthropology, which is, you know. So, I don't know, I mean, this is an axis around which this whole naming process comes to me through in my practice. I mean, it's not a fixed thing, but it's a shift of grips, a shift of intensities, attentions, desires, contexts in which we want to name things, and then move on to something else. I mean, I might have been interested in historical action at one point in time and interpolated by extremely reactionary ideas because I was growing up in a world, but then through my life I decide that, you know, through experience I realize that that grip is not really important, and I move on to a far looser grip on naming and come to something else, which can go towards inner speech rather than projected performative speech, spectacle, and things like that. So, I mean, I don't know.
I'd like to shift from the problem of naming to the problem of self-naming, which is, I think, also an interesting set of questions and lead to interesting possibilities and problems. And the reason why I'm saying this is to return to your freakers and hackers example. Giving oneself a name often takes on a contrarian character, a kind of, there's a performative oppositional stance. So when we say we are alternative art or whatever, you know, these kind of things. And I think that there are consequences of what happens when you make that name. Like you said, if you say community art, you end up willy-nilly doing some things even if you didn't want to do them because you've called yourself community art. Now, I think it's interesting to actually shift the focus away from the name as a picture of what you think you'd like to present to the world of who you are, to the name as a make-do word for the moment, which tries to describe what you do. And there are two very different sets of consequences that can happen as a result of that. And since you've objected to heavy philosophical biases, I'm going to introduce a botanical bias, again, returning to bamboos or whatever, which is the difference, for instance, between two kinds of plant structures, which are parasitic and epiphytic. And epiphytic plant structures are often confused for parasitic plant structures. A true parasite is something that attaches itself to another form, another organism, and by doing so saps it of its life energy. So it is truly subversive. An epiphyte, for instance, orchids, which Assam is famous for, we can buy them at the airport, only uses the architecture of the other organism as a form of support in order to do what it has to do without actually killing the other. So in our bodies, there are both parasites and epiphytes, and often we confuse the term and we call epiphytic bacteria parasitic, whereas actually they're not. They're even helpful to us. Dono mar jate. Now, the point is that often I find that artistic subjectivities and artistic actions in their process of self-naming confuse a parasitic function and an epiphytic function. Perhaps their relationship with the mainstream, with the attention economy, let's say, is not necessarily subversive. It may be epiphytic. A good example that you talked about was efflux. It actually uses the structures of the mainstream attention economy to be able to do a lot of things, do a lot of other things. And in doing so, it also is beneficial in some senses to the mainstream economy. There are instances, however, where even this act of benign leaning on a structure can create problems. And those are also interesting. Because phone freakers, never had any intention of disrupting the telephone networks. They were not interested in bringing the phone networks of AT&T down. They were only interested in using it in off-peak hours to be able to do their own little thrup, thrup, whatever they were doing, right? But the phone companies at one time reacted very badly to their presence. And this is interesting because they were not setting out to be subversive at all, but by their action, by their epiphytic action, they revealed a face of the phone company in the sense that it said that we are the only people who will determine how our architecture is used. And anybody else who is doing something like using the front of a bank to hold to put the bags on, if anybody else uses our architecture to lean on for some purposes, we will destroy. Now, that reveals something about the company. It reveals something about the company saying it will not permit an act of peaceful coexistence on terms other than set out by itself. So even if you're not engaging in intentionally subversive action, the consequences of your action have an interesting revelatory phenomenon. And very often, agents who set out to subvert, who set out to be radical, end up reinforcing the structures, contrary-wise. Which is why we are often very reluctant to get into a discussion when people ask us, so are you political artists or not? We say that's not for us to say. You know, I mean, because any attempt to create these kind of self-descriptive categories usually ends up boxing you into either the parasite form or the epiphyte form, whereas you might be one or the other depending on the circumstances. And that's why it's more interesting to describe or attempt to describe always incompletely the actions that you're doing rather than create a representation of yourself through an act of naming, which is only a kind of some kind of mirror of who you are.
It's often pointed out that parasites also, I mean, it's actually pointed out in the original meaning of the word parasite. The parasite is the host. I mean, is the guest, the uninvited guest at the table. The thing is that in French, the word host also means guest. But and that the uninvited guest may eat at the master's table, but if they eat all the food and put into peril the very existence of the master, they too will be put into peril. The pilot fish, for example, which follow sharks, are in this sense epiphytic, as you described. But I think generally, I think the parasite is, in most cases, also epiphytic. I don't know. I know that. I think that a parasite is an epithet where the system goes wrong. Because a parasite cannot destroy its host organism without destroying its own environment.
It migrates. Parasites typically migrate at the point of the death of the host organism, so they seek the next, which is why epidemics spread. Mm. If viruses didn't have to migrate, there would not be epidemics. And the reason they migrate is because they've outlasted the host.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in some other kind of plants, which I found out about. In the weeding and de-weeding process in organic farming, farmers identify these indicator plants, which by themselves might not be desired to be there, but they indicate things about the soil fertility, things like nutrition, which is present there, and things like that, which make the farmers allow them to be there because they act like information agents.
I'm going to move out of farming. Been very urban all my life. I don't really know plants too well. But I think this is interesting because I'm going to bring in light and shadows at play and try to see what happens in that particular space. Because there is a certain valorization of excavating a shadow economy or people who are in the gray areas, and we seem to think that they're generally put upon as a binary opposition, so that there is a mainstream economy and then there is a negative or a gray economy which we are calling the shadow economy of certain sort. I want to kind of dismantle the binary and look upon how the shadow economy, just in the case of what you are talking about, parasites and the host and the epiphytes, the shadow economy actually only not only reconstructs but reinforces the mainstream in certain ways as well. And what I'm going to do is not really produce examples from practice, because I'm not essentially a practitioner, but give you this really interesting fable that I discovered when I was in China, and it's a translation, and it's about the penumbra and its query to the shadow. And I'm just putting it out because I think it's an interesting discussion point. So the penumbra said to shadow, "A little while ago, you were walking, and now you're standing still. A little while ago, you were sitting, and now you're standing up. Why this lack of independent action?" And the shadow said, "Do I have to wait for something before I can be like this? Does what I wait for also have to wait for something before it can be like this? Am I waiting for the scales of a snake or the wings of a cicada? How do I know why it is so? How do I know why it isn't so?" Penumbra once asked shadow, "A little while ago you were looking down and now you're looking up. A little while ago your hair was bound up and now it's hanging loose. A little while ago you were sitting and now you're standing up a little. A while ago you were walking and now you are still. Why is this?" And the shadow said, "Quibble, quibble. Why bother ask about such things? I have them, but I don't know how. I am the shell of the cicada, the cast off skin of the snake, like them and yet not like them. In firelight or sunlight I draw together, in darkness or night I fade away. Am I not dependent on the substance from which I am thrown? And that substance is itself dependent on something else. When it comes, I come with it. When it goes, I go with it. When it comes under the influence of the strong yang, I come under the same. Since we are both produced by that strong yang, what occasion is there for you to question me?" And I think this is an extremely interesting fable, because the idea is that the shadow presents itself as the darkness that follows or attends upon form or substance when and where there is light. So shadow comes together and changes following substance and light. But not only does the shadow not have self-autonomy, but she lacks constancy and loyalty. That time, space, light, direction, distance, and speed can all make her change in this particular direction. Like the rudder of a boat, for example, in a strong wind. Yet, should one want to get rid of the shadow in the manner of throwing away an old shoe, one will not find that she can be trampled into disappearance, that the shadow will reproduce itself materially in terms of light and its connectedness with light. Because as long as there is light, shadow is that silent darkness that cannot be shed. When substance runs from shadow in the light of day, substance can run to the death as well. And this is the parasitic combination, actually. That the shadow can be annihilated only if the mainstream or the light can be annihilated as well. Shadow would still be there unless substance were to then enter into darkness. And I think that is why the penumbra, which is the light shade outlining the shadow, is much more interesting. Because the shadow of a shadow is that nothing or no matter that everyone has almost forgotten. That the penumbra is too far away from substance to be seen or discerned. And the Chinese word for penumbra or wang liang is not really very common usage. It has nothing to do with the language of the everyday. Or even in English, we need a dictionary, an exegetical text to understand what it means. Many have come to know the term first and then try to explain in terms of, you know, turn to examine the shadow because of it. Besides the shadow which is without subjectivity, in this particular fable, there is the penumbra which is even less of a subject who is actually asking the question. In the fable, the substance does not exist, but the substance is constantly reinforced by its invocation in the shadow's responses to penumbra. So I'm just saying that for me, the particular fable was interesting because these blurred indeterminacies that we are trying to talk about, which maybe are not shadow but are penumbra, are seen as not having characteristics sometimes, or they cannot be contingent upon form or substance. And they remain in the margin of the shadow, and this is where resistance or subversiveness comes in. that if there are new questions which need to be asked, maybe they are not within the shadow, but within the penumbra. That the identification of the shadow is only reinforcing the particular structure of the mainstream, and asking questions from there is not really going to be important, because the questions which you, perhaps we need to answer are asked from the penumbra, and they are never really heard in any way. So it's a very metaphorical fable there, but I just wanted to bring it to the floor.
I think that definitely bears some... it's certainly food for reflection, so perhaps we could combine it with some food for... Okay, so let's break for lunch and...
One little annotation, an anecdote. I was witness to a charming conversation between Martha Rosler and Anton Vidocqui not very long ago, in which she complained, patiently saying, "You didn't include all my books in gardening or cookery."